It's Wednesday, May 2nd, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Tom Brokaw fights back against allegations of sexual misconduct, and more than 60 female co-workers are standing behind them. Or are we? We'll talk about that. Also, the comeback of AM radio in Puerto Rico as residents on the island search for local news and information with little access to it. And how local television stations are using Facebook and why local audiences seem to be seeing right through it. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But I want to start with Saturday night's White House Correspondents' Dinner and the debate that continues today over that event. Comedian Michelle Wolff served as the evening's entertainment. Her 15-minute act left many in the room uncomfortable, offended, and questioning a lot. Here's just a part of what she had to say about White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies. And I'm never really sure what to call Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You know, is it Sarah Sanders? Is it Sarah Huckabee Sanders? Is it Cousin Huckabee? Is it Auntie Huckabee Sanders? Like, what's Uncle Tom but for white women who disappoint other white women? Oh, I know, Aunt Coulter.
Sanders sat there, pretty much deadpan, through Wolf's routine, while others walked out of the performance. Wolf's set became the story. Sunday morning, White House Correspondents Association President Margaret Talov responded to some of the criticism on CNN's reliable sources.
My only regret is that, to some extent, those 15 minutes are now defining 4 hours of what was a really wonderful and unifying night. And I don't want the cause of unity to be undercut.
You're saying a celebration of the First Amendment was overshadowed by Wolf's raunchy jokes.
Well, I mean, to some extent, and look, the comedian, when the entertainer is a comedian, and as has been the case for most of the last 30 years or so, they are often controversial. They are often, to some extent, polarizing or at least provocative.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's a night about free speech. So by tradition, we do not vet their monologue. We don't censor it. We don't even see it. In fact,
so you don't see the jokes beforehand. That's interesting.
I did sneak down to the rehearsal and walkthrough just in case, but she wouldn't give anything up.
So that is a risk that you run when you have a comedian as the entertainment at an event like this. They too have First Amendment rights, but it still felt like it backfired. It undermined everything that we've talked about the news media wanting to do and try to accomplish in its constant warring with the Trump administration.
I mean, it seems to me this is just one more example of why, as we've been saying over the past few years now, they just should do away with the way they do it. If they want to honor students and honor journalists, they can do that in a way that's respectful. I don't have anything against the comedian doing what she does. She has a First Amendment right to do that. It's entertaining to a lot of people, but in that context, it wasn't. And then in that context, it made it even worse for White House reporters to try to have some semblance of a relationship with Sarah Huckabee Sanders in the White House when they really need that, given all of the friction between them.
Yeah, I mean, I think every year we've had this conversation about whether or not this event is relevant. And I think it's... I believe that it is relevant in terms of what the mission of the organization is and the good things that they do for journalists, both professional as well as students. But this dinner has become a yearly controversy. It was controversial during the Clinton administration, during George W. Bush's administration. I think Obama was controversy sometimes, and then sometimes it worked because there was a somewhat of a cordial relationship mm-hmm. between the journalists and Obama's. But now it's not working, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that Trump is basically, as he says it, at war with the mainstream media, and now it's become this sort of partisan battle.
Well, and one of the things that strikes me is you're right. We have had this argument for what, Mike? I took over hosting. Right,
years.
I took over hosting the program from you almost 4 years ago. So I know almost the 4 years that I've been writing the scripts and selecting the topics. We've talked about it almost every year. What's interesting is the reason for the controversy and how that has evolved from year to year to year. Something new every year.
The difference this time is that since the president wasn't there, but he allowed his White House staff and past staff to show up, the comedian takes aim at them, mm-hmm. the staff. Now, I'm not saying that Kellyanne Conway or Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you know, aren't big girls and can't take care of themselves, but when you're attacking the staff with your jokes rather than the person who has the real power, I think that's a problem.
And that's a civil servant versus an elected official, too, right. In that case.
Right. Plus, you have this situation of people coming to their defense now and say, well, she has a First Amendment right to say this. But, you know, here's the problem. It's not an eye for an eye. The journalists are saying, well, maybe because the White House lies to us and attacks us, it's okay for us to attack them. Not in that venue. Do it through your reporting.
And what makes it even more of a strange dynamic is that the president doesn't show up, but he holds a counter programs mm-hmm. the event. So now you've got these competing events. Instead of all the participants in the room engaging each other, now you've got this counter thing where he's in Michigan, they're in DC. DC is seen as this strange place, and then he goes out to Michigan to talk to real Americans about how he's being vilified and basically run through the mud by the DC establishment, and then you turn it on and there it is.
Well, and this always brings back the really sticky situation for us, the three of us personally, and for our colleagues here, is that this event is designed to raise scholarship money, and those scholarships are going to our students. And I don't just mean like our students in the general sense of our students. I mean our students. I mean, there were two people walking across that stage who I've had in multiple classes in my classroom who I've mentored and want to see them benefit.
No, in fact, I mean, there were 10 Missouri students out of the 20-some that got them this time.
Two of the 10 were students I've personally worked with.
And that's important.
It is.
And the way they get the money for these scholarships, some of the money for these scholarships, is by having this event. And if there are celebrities there and comedians there, maybe more people buy tables. But frankly, if news organizations, which buy most of these tables, aren't willing to do the same thing to support the future of journalism without having a comedian there lashing out at the administration, then that says something bad about our business.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think that there are other ways in which the Correspondents Association could raise funds. And I'm with Mike, if media organizations are really interested in helping these students to become the next generation of journalists, then you donate directly.
You don't need a piece of rubber chicken to go ahead and make that donation.
Right.
Okay, well, I'm almost afraid to bring up anything relating to the investigations and charges against Governor Greitens. Given what happened to us when we had this show 2 weeks ago, we talked about it during our 1 p.m. taping, and by the time the show actually ran at 6:30 on KBIA's air, it was already dated when the governor had filed a restraining order against Attorney General Josh Hawley. The judge has since thrown that out, and now Hawley is looking into how the governor is using Facebook. So again, we run the risk of talking about this now at 1:15 and having it become dated by 6:30, but talk a little bit about this investigation. We've talked in the past about circumventing reporters using Facebook. Attorney General is not too happy about it now, too.
As I understand it, it involves a time when the governor had just one Facebook page. It had been used for the campaign, but then a state employee had posted something on there after he was governor. Does that violate the law? And it very well might. And that's something that the attorney general, you'd think, whether they're running for office or not, should be investigating. I don't know if it's as big a deal as the donor list or surely the invasion of privacy case against the governor. But even if Hawley wasn't running for the U.S. Senate, it would behoove him to be investigating this. And he has to be tough if he's running for office. And not just perceived to be tough, I think, but he has to be tough or he doesn't have a chance. He's going to be seen as covering up for a governor who's not even popular with his own party.
Yeah. And I mean, when you sit back and you look at how the media coverage has evolved over this, I mean, now the Greitens investigation is a nightly segment of every newscast. It is a part of every front page of every newspaper in the state.
Here locally and nationally. I accidentally slipped in Sunday morning, and the first thing I did when I turned on Meet the Press is I'm watching as they're asking Roy Blunt right then and there to comment on it and asking if the governor should resign. Roy Blunt being among the few Republicans saying right now that that's up to the governor. But still, we're seeing this implosion that is just not going away.
I mean, and you know, we're coming up to the end of the legislative session, mm-hmm. and there's already talk that as early as either this week or next week, they're going to vote to go immediately into special session to impeach the governor. So this is going to continue for a while now. And I think his trial starts either this week or I think it's next week. His trial starts in St. Louis County.
Well, speaking of that case, there has been another, the blackmail case, there has been another interesting development as it relates to that one. And this one is a little bit, I don't know, it's kind of cloudy for members of the general public. I'm hoping we can help clear it up a little bit. The owner of the Missouri Times has apparently given $50,000 to the attorney representing the ex-husband.
In cash.
Not
in an envelope.
$50,000. The handcuffed briefcase. But gave him $50,000 in cash to the attorney that was representing the ex-husband of the woman in the center of that case. A lot of people out there saying this doesn't help kind of any of that idea of like the media being independent. Let's talk a little bit about the Missouri Times and who that organization is.
It's an independent online news service out of Jefferson City. At least when it was first started, it had more of a conservative bent to it. Scott Fawn, the guy who's running it now, the owner, used to be, I think, a politician or local government official in southeast Missouri.
Yeah, I want to say in the Cape Girardeau area.
Right, and then he's been running this paper. It has run articles lately about Greitens, many of them negative, but then a lot of news coverage about Greitens has been negative. The thing of it is, though, is that if he was paying money to this attorney at around the time when all this stuff was coming out, what was that all about? He claimed in a statement that he did a video that he did online,
okay.
right?
The Missouri Times.
Scott Fawn from the Missouri Times.
I just wanted to clarify the he.
Right.
We've done a lot of those here.
He said that he was doing because he was working on a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't really clarify it very much to me.
Yeah, book on what is what I would like to know. No, I saw the same thing. I mean, it's – but then someone pointed out to me, they said, okay, this guy, Fawn, paid $50,000 – the question still goes back to, did the governor or did the governor not do what he is being charged with doing? I mean, we're still talking about what some would consider to be impeachable offenses, mm-hmm. or at least offenses that would require censure and some kind of discipline. You know, and it's really become a problem for the Republican Party. Going back to what you were talking about, you have, you know, Josh Hawley out there running against Claire McCaskill.
The luckiest woman in national politics.
Exactly. If this continues, it's going to make it awfully difficult for him to be able to unseat her.
But it does matter, at least from a perception standpoint, if somebody running a paper, and if who else provided the other $50,000, if they're, quote, enemies of the governor, that's going to help him.
Right. No, you're right. You're right.
Okay, so Mike, I noticed that you commented on a Facebook post that I made last week when the Washington Post published its story with the headline, NBC News Faces Skepticism in Remedying In-House Sexual Harassment. I was frustrated that I read through paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs of that story detailing how NBC was investigating the allegations against Matt Lauer. And at the very end, allegations from a former reporter that Tom Brokaw had acted inappropriately toward her in the 90s. I'm sorry, but as a journalism student in the 90s, especially here, and I had mentioned that every time I was reading Brokaw, I kept hearing one of our former faculty members, Bill Silcock, say, Brokaw! Just like he used to in the KOMU newsroom at 5:30. Like, for me, Tom Brokaw has always been, you know, the person at the top of the hill, the one we're looking up to, especially in television news, and to hear that he was now being accused in a Me Too situation at the very bottom of a Washington Post, they buried the lead.
They really did bury the lead. And frankly, I wonder if because there was one on the record source and one anonymous source, and Brokaw being who he is, if the Post kind of downplayed that in the first angle of the story. Variety, which also ran the story, did not.
No.
They had a video interview with Linda Vester, the former reporter. And yeah, I mean, I agree. Brokaw was a hero to many of us in broadcast journalism. And he's this elder statesman, the guy that referencing the greatest generation, all this stuff. But he also was a very powerful figure. And that's why, that's why you see now it's up to, I think, 100 women who have signed onto a letter saying that they support him. Although Variety reports that some of those women felt pressured
coerced
to do so.
And pressured into doing so, and that perhaps they don't necessarily support as heavily. They didn't want to be seen as the person in the newsroom or in the building not signing the letter.
But, you know, I see this is different. Brokaw is handling it much differently than the other broadcast journalists and other journalists who have got...
This smells a little like the Aziz Ansari case that we had talked about.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, he immediately came out and in strong language... basically denouncing this and saying that, you know, this was a perp walk and he was...
Called it a drive-by shooting.
A drive-by shooting. I mean, he was using some very, direct language. And I think that pushback has sort of changed this narrative to a certain extent. Not saying that he's been totally absolved and NBC is not having to deal with this. But I think in some ways it's sort of raising questions as to the veracity of this woman's charge, and especially when the initial 60 women signed on. I mean, you got some heavy names there. I mean, Rachel Maddow,
Andrea Mitchell.
I mean, you've got some really heavy names at NBC who signed on to that.
I would like to believe that this might be different, and I would like to believe that the way he responded might suggest that it's different. But hey, first of all, the women who were the co-hosts with Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer were out there defending him before they weren't defending him. And if you look at the language that Tom Brokaw used in this 4 a.m. email he wrote, there are some parts of that he probably wished he hadn't said, whether he is guilty or not. I mean, it was sort of classic shaming the victim language that he was using, calling her the married to a wealthy man, who she had a modest career at Fox, who she failed in her attempt to, you know, at being a success in the business. And then basically he goes on to describe how, well, I probably shouldn't have gone to her room, but if anything, I gave her maybe a good night kiss on the cheek. No. I don't know that
which is still pretty inappropriate.
I don't think this stuff absolves him in
any
way.
Oh, no. I don't think it absolves him or NBC. The only thing I'm talking about is the way in which he went after it immediately, I think, is different from what the other situations were. But I think that NBC has a problem. They've got to deal with this, because now you've got a second big star, probably your biggest star, who is now having to do with these investigations. And let's go back to the investigation, which was
supposedly the status of said investigation? Why is it entirely internal?
And that's the thing that sort of jumped out at me is, wait a minute, what happened to that? Because that was a couple of months ago, and you said that you were going to be public in this, and we've heard nothing.
Which is why it's interesting. If we can go back to that Washington Post story that I was so disappointed in. Yeah. If that is the point of the story, is how is NBC handling these investigations, again, why not lead with Tom Brokaw and how is this being investigated? Like, they buried that.
Well, I think part of the reason, I think Mike is right. I think part of the reason why they buried it is because they didn't feel comfortable with the sources that they had, and they didn't want to be seen, in case the Variety story sort of tanked, they didn't want to be out front there and get caught in the backwash on that. I think that was part of the reasoning for that.
And I think you're absolutely right that NBC still has a lot of potential liability here. That report has not come out yet. But what did come out in Variety's reporting today, I think it was, or maybe yesterday, NBC did send around a memo internally to their reporters and anchors, basically saying, you've got to quote from the email of the, and you've got to quote from the women who supported him. And it made it look like they were dictating to their personnel that they should give every benefit of the doubt to Brokaw.
Okay. Well, on our show going back to about February 7th, we talked about a new service that you could subscribe to, MoviePass. It would let you pay $10 a month to go and see one movie a day. At the time, we were pretty sure the business model wouldn't last. Mike's sitting there laughing. We talked about how it sounded way too good to be true. And already it's changing, and pretty significantly. What is the new plan? You're sitting there laughing at me.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the business model didn't make a lot of sense unless you agreed with assumptions that you probably can't agree with. But here's what they've done. They went from saying you could go to see a movie a day, right, for $10 a month for as long as you wanted. Well, now they're not taking any new subscribers temporarily for that kind of deal, but instead you can see 4 movies a month for 3 months at a time, and but we'll throw in a free subscription to iHeartRadio's digital service. And so it looks like they're losing a lot of money. They were counting on, first of all, having theaters that do deals with them, maybe even give them concession revenues, a lot of other ways that they were going to generate cash besides losing money on every ticket sale, and nah, it doesn't look so good.
I mean, you know, as you said, we were talking about this a couple, and we were all looking at each other going like, this is not going to work. And clearly, the way in which they originally had it set up is not going to work. I don't think it's going to work the way they have it set up now, because what was like 4 movies? Is that what you...
4 movies a month.
4 movies a month, right? For the same price, right?
I mean, still $10 for 4 movies is a pretty good deal, but...
Well, now you're getting the iHeartRadio subscription.
You get iHeartRadio. And if you go and you look at the story that's on our Links blog, the owner of this is basically saying that, well, no, we're fine financially. We could go on for several years. We've got $130 million.
Can I pick on this guy for a second?
Go ahead.
Buried in one of those stories on our Links blog mentions that the guy who owns 92% of the company used to own the Psychic Friends Network with the Orlick. I don't know where I want you to
but
go.
But it's
kind of
funny that the other 8%, the 8 to 6% is owned by Verizon, and I'm like, how did they fit into that, and why only that small of amount?
Well, the other part that's really curious to me too is that iHeartRadio, the premium product that comes with this, that company filed for bankruptcy back in March.
Exactly.
So where and how do we see this going anywhere? Well, and are we going to be sitting here in August laughing at them again?
iHeartRadio needs subscribers, you know, and the subscribers might help them to generate some revenue to get back from bankruptcy protection. But the other thing that they're doing...
But you connect to a company that's headed to bankruptcy?
Well, and they're shooting themselves in the foot in another way, too.
One way to do it.
Now they say, well, you can go see any movies you want for a month, but you can only see one... You can't see the same movie more than once. So if it's a big blockbuster, you want to...
So you mean I can't go see Infinity Wars like 4 times?
You can't go see Infinity Wars 4 times. You can't do that. Nope.
Okay. Well, some of my segues are better than others. And this one, I'm going to tell you right now, is not good. So I'm going to own it. But we were kind of talking about radio, so we're going to keep talking about radio. This time, terrestrial AM radio. It's popular among some segments of people, folks who are interested in sports talk or those who listen to nationally syndicated programs such as Rush Limbaugh, and in big markets, motorists who need real-time traffic reports. But on the whole, those are really niche audiences that haven't really been growing in numbers, except in Puerto Rico. There, 3 AM radio stations have found new life in the months after Hurricane Maria devastated the island and have really been serving as a lifeline for its people. This really does speak to the power of radio in ways that maybe I hadn't considered before I saw some of the articles that are on our Links blog.
And when you hear the examples that they're giving about just how vital this was and how journalists came together around these radio stations, it's a feel-good story in one way, but in another way, it says something about any other place in America. These are American citizens. If the power was out this long that folks were relying on AM radio as their only means of communication, you'd say something was seriously wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it also speaks to the, I guess, the resiliency of the people of Puerto Rico and all of its, you know, you talk about the economy, you talk about getting the power back on. I mean, just the basic things. But the one of the things I found fascinating about the story was we're talking about transistor,
right,
radios.
Right, we are talking about 2 AA batteries. Yeah. What's
or crank
radios. Oh, crank radios and AA batteries, that is what's keeping people informed and connected.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if you have a cell phone, you're
Dead in the,
you're dead.
I shouldn't say that. I was about to say dead in the water. It's a really bad choice of words right now.
Exactly. It's a bad choice of words, but literally you are out of communication if you have a... So, but if you have a transistor radio, you know where to go. You know where there is power.
Yeah.
You know where there can, where you can get help. Those kinds of things. And that's really important.
You know, and as I sit here and think about how we produce this program and how it live streams on the internet, how we are creating video, how we're putting it on YouTube, how we're trying to reach people on mobile, that's all good and well, but really that power of radio is what it all comes down to, and that maybe we're trying to think a little too high tech sometimes and bringing our coverage out.
One other thing, I mean, you know, just a little cross promotion here, but NPR is doing a series of stories on Puerto Rico talking about how certain things that happen in terms of their economy, in terms of business practices, in terms of the not up keeping upkeep with their infrastructure, how all of that led to where we are now, and how the U.S. government and corporate entities were complicit in this, and they're doing that this week.
Okay. While we're on the subject of local coverage, what exactly is local, and how much not-so-local content will audiences take from their hometown news sources before they get fed up? There's an interesting piece on our links blog about a survey that was done among TV stations and also looking at the content that they're putting on Facebook and finding only about 50% of the content local television stations are posting is local to that market, and audiences are starting to see through it.
Yeah, there's a great deal of variability in this. I mean, there was an academic study looked at a cross-section of TV station websites from around the country, big stations, small stations. And they did find, though, that on average, about half the content is local. What's the other half? Well, it's stuff, first of all, it's coming from their group owners who own services that are promoting stories on all of their websites. And sometimes that's fine, but sometimes it can crowd out local stories. And when you get to the situation now where, like, local newspapers are folding, local TV stations, as we said on this show before, have to step up to the plate, because otherwise there's going to be news deserts in a lot of these communities. So more local, not less.
Yeah, I think you're already seeing those news deserts pop up. I mean, you know, part of the problem with this is that, you know, you're having this shrinking number of journalists out there covering it. So it's almost like they have to go and get 50% from somewhere else because they aren't able to generate enough news to be able to populate that. So I think that's one of the huge problems that they're dealing with right now.
For the audience, though, where and how does that become frustrating when you're seeing either the same clickbait from another market or you're seeing something and you have that crowd out that you're looking for that local coverage you can count on or where the news comes first?
Well, problem is because you're promoting it that way, and then you people turn to that and they only get 50% of it and they get frustrated. So I think that's where a lot of the frustration is coming from.
Okay, well, I'm looking at the clock, and we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Austin Howard is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.